It's Monday, March 7, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. As we watch the situations in Tunisia and Egypt unfold, this much was clear. We had a sense from the very beginning that the trajectory was toward the toppling of the regimes. Now, especially when it comes to the Mubarak regime, this seemed almost incredible. You're talking about a 30-year dictatorship that had been really propped up with a lot of Western support and even American defense money, and it appeared that this was a very stable regime. But when you saw what was going on in the streets and we started hearing the reports of youth going into the streets, willing to take the political risk, the big question for all of us was where this was going. And that question we knew was inevitably answered not so much by the dictators in Tunisia and in Egypt, but by their militaries. When the military in those two nations refused to stand with the regime, refused to shoot their own citizens, and in particular their own young in defense of the regime, we saw that there was a trajectory that seemed inevitable. Mubarak would fall, and any leader will fall if there's a popular revolt on the streets, and the military basically either sides with the protesters. That did not happen, but they did remain neutral, and that appeared almost unprecedented. Well, the situation in Libya, by contrast, is very different. Over the weekend, the intensification of fighting in Libya is demonstrating that Muammar Gaddafi, the despotic dictator, the terrorist leader, let's just call it for what it is, in Libya, is willing to use terrorism against his own people. And even though he has been unable to mobilize all of his military against the insurgency, he has been able to organize a good bit of them, including about 6,000 to 7,000 troops under his personal command. And beyond that, the troops that he cannot get to fire, he will hire. He's been going especially to Africa and hiring mercenaries to be used against his own citizens. Now, there's a great deal of embarrassment going on here, and the embarrassment is very much deserved. Let's talk about why. Western nations have been about the process of deluding themselves about Muammar Gaddafi for the better part of the last 20 years. We need to remember that this man was nuts from the very beginning. He demonstrated his nearly irrational personality with his writings and rantings. He, after all, has a horrifying human rights record. This is a man who has been behind both state-sponsored terrorism, just remember the Lockerbie bombing, and then also remember that he's been supposedly on the side of the angels, as we are told and as various successive American administrations have said that Libya is now playing ball with us when it comes to limiting the spread of al-Qaeda and Islamic terrorism. But now there's a great deal of embarrassment. The embarrassment is particularly acute in European capitals, and it's because of a game that has been played for the last 20 years or more on the question of human rights. Now, let's talk about why that is so. The issue of human rights ought to be fairly straightforward, should it not? What we're talking about here is something that's legally defined. We're talking here about something that most of us can understand. We talk about something that is central to the American experience and to the American self-consciousness. And yet you go to the United Nations and you come to understand that human rights there must mean something very different. This reminds me of what the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor points out that happens under a secularized regime. He points out that a secular morality apparently is too unstable to sustain any common notion of human rights. Let's look at some evidence for that. The United Nations Security Council, or in particular the United Nations Human Rights Council. That's a 47-group nation council, and when you start looking at that, you realize that, well, let's remember something. Libya was once the chairman nation of that particular council. In other words, the Libyan delegate served as the chairman. Now, if that isn't selling the soul of the Human Rights Council, it's hard to imagine what would be. And now, let's rewind history. Not back to 1979, not back to 1999, not even 99 days. Let's go back to January of 2011. The 47-nation council of the Human Nations Human Rights Council was adopting a report on Libya. These are some of the things that were said. Algeria noted the efforts of the Libyan Arab Party to promote human rights. This is, by the way, coming from the primary source section of Sunday's edition of the New York Times. The Syrian Arab Republic praised the Libyans for its serious commitment and interaction with the Human Rights Council and its mechanisms. North Korea, yes, that's right. North Korea praised the Libyan Arab government for its achievements in the protection of human rights, especially in the field of economic and social rights, etc., etc. Other nations that commended Libya included Bahrain, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Tunisia, the Bolivian Republic, in this case the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, and also Cuba, Egypt, the Islamic Republic of Iran, Myanmar, and the Libyan Arab government, then invited all non-governmental organizations and other relevant stakeholders in the council to visit Libya so they could see in person the status of human rights on the ground. If that's not embarrassing enough, the United States of America supported the Libyan effort to increase engagement with the international community. It called on the country to comply with its human rights treaty obligations, but said nothing stronger. Well, we're saying stronger things now. You might say that was then and this is now. You might say that this incredible turnaround has to do with the fact that all of these nations were playing games with human rights before the United Nations, and this game got called the foul. What we have here is that the visible actions of Muammar Gaddafi have called not only his own regime into disrepute, but also the human rights process of the international foreign policy establishment, and in particular, the human rights process of the United Nations Human Rights Council. Now, all of this is also background to a very interesting and indeed excruciating question that is now faced by the American administration. Do we intervene in Libya? Now, there's a very interesting kind of double-mindedness that sets into the foreign policy elites on this question, and also a good deal of populist concern as well. On the one hand, you have conservatives who are generally willing to use military force where it appears to be clearly in the national interest. There are also concerns for human rights on the right, and yet there's a humility when it comes to the enforcement of such issues because there's a sense that such efforts often come to spectacular failure. Then on the other side, you have a foreign policy establishment made up largely of the liberals who are arguing against military intervention in almost every situation except the ones in which they believe military intervention is now morally necessary. So on the right, there is more of a sliding scale of cost-benefit analysis. And on the left, there's a matter which is supposedly of inflexible principle. But it's very interesting when you note this. Neither side can consistently maintain any kind of approach to foreign policy that is not largely constructed anew with every international crisis. That's what crises do. Crises do not play by our games. They don't play by our rules. And Libya right now is presenting the Obama administration with one of those excruciating moral choices. Must we intervene? Well, there are those who are saying we absolutely must. Just look at the human rights chaos that is happening. Look at the catastrophe that is looming. Look at the thousands of refugees going into Tunisia. Look at the war that he's playing on his own people. So there is a call from many people in different political sectors for the United States and NATO, the only group that is capable of doing this, to enforce a no-fly zone over Libya. But Secretary of Defense Robert Gates is exactly right. A no-fly zone is, A, an act of war. It would involve, as a first act, knocking out Libyan ground-to-air defenses, which would mean, well, inviting a retaliatory strike that could lead to the death of Americans. And once our blood and treasure is involved, then we are basically in a third new military action in addition to Afghanistan and Iraq. The second issue here, if that was A, then B, is the strategic limitation of the United States military already fighting two very active, very costly wars. But it's interesting to see the debate now. The debate is between those who say that we should not intervene and those who say that we absolutely must intervene, both on the basis of principle. In the real world, in a Genesis 3 world, these kinds of principles come into conflict. That conflict seems to be inevitable. We need to admit it up front. One of the most humbling aspects of our humanity is that when it comes to international affairs, a good deal of flexibility seems to be absolutely mandated by reality. As much as we want to be driven by a concern for human rights, there's a limitation to what the United States can do as the policeman to the world. There's a limitation not only in terms of blood and treasure, to use the old language, but there's a limitation in terms even of political will. And there's also a limitation writ large in terms of how we may not intervene, because at some point, not intervening turns out to be even more problematic than intervening. Now, the Obama administration appears to be seeking its footing on this. The Democratic Party and Democratic administration seem to be a little less sure-footed on these questions than Republicans. But when it comes to this kind of issue, let's be honest, this kind of situation would humble an administration of any president of any party. We'll be watching this one closely with you. Speaking of watching, we need to be watching what's going on in New York City. In New York City, this past Wednesday, the city council passed a resolution that will have the force of law, a measure that would address what the New York Times calls the problem of crisis pregnancy centers that masquerade as licensed medical facilities but are in fact fronts for anti-abortion groups that interfere with women's ability to make timely, well-informed decisions about their reproductive health, end quote. Now, I am so tempted to take the time just to dissect that kind of language. That's Orwellian. They're accusing these groups of interfering with a woman's ability – notice all the qualified statements here – to make timely, well-informed decisions about what? Their reproductive health. Well, what these crisis pregnancy centers actually are centers that interfere with the intended death of an unborn human being. Let's be honest. And that's worth interfering for. Now, what's going on here is, of course, what is taking place elsewhere, and in particular, we'll note in just a moment, in the city of Baltimore, Maryland. But in New York City, this appears even more unconscionable. Remember that this is basically abortion central in the United States. We talked recently about the fact that the statistic has revealed that 41% of all pregnancies end in abortion in New York City. And now they're saying that's not enough? Well, that's exactly what the city council basically has said, and it was a massive vote, by the way. And Mayor Bloomberg says that within the coming weeks he will sign this into the force of law. What's going on here? Well, there are these crisis pregnancy centers that, after all, are having an effect, at least a marginal effect. But it's a major effect when it comes to individual lives that are saved. There are crisis pregnancy centers, and they advertise services, including ultrasound services, to pregnant women. Well, those who are adamantly for abortion and almost with a moral mandate for abortion want to silence these crisis pregnancy centers, and they're doing their very best to do so. And now the New York City Council becomes the next in line to try to outlaw the right of these crisis pregnancy centers to avail themselves of a service to the city that would lead women to be able to reconsider the act of an abortion. Now you say, well, is there some kind of pressure that is being put on a woman by the knowledge of the life that is within her? Let me ask you a question. From a Christian or biblical perspective, is that not the kind of pressure that we believe a human being should be under? That is, the knowledge of what we are doing and its consequences? But that's just too much for the New York City Council. Now, I mentioned Baltimore, and I did so because just recently a federal judge ruled that that city's effort to do this very thing is unconstitutional because it was a limitation upon free speech. The New York City Council was advised of that, even as a federal court ruling, and they went ahead anyway. We can only hope that sanity will prevail in this case and that that federal precedent will be upheld in the city of New York. 41 out of every 100 pregnancies already ending in abortion. Before leaving the issue of abortion this Monday morning, I want to draw attention to a news article that appeared last week in the Philadelphia Inquirer. I was in Philadelphia, and I have the paper here in my hand. It was buried at the bottom of the front page, barely visible, but with a headline, the news article says this: Gosnell could face the death penalty. We're talking here about abortion. Dr. Kermit Gosnell, you'll remember the House of Horrors that was discovered there in Philadelphia, where a number of babies had been born alive, that is, seven infants, and then murdered by him when they were born live. You may remember that a woman also died as she was anticipating an abortion. She waited and she died of malpractice. And now he's being charged with murder. And in Pennsylvania, he's being charged with capital murder, held in prison without bail, his wife held in lieu of a $1 million bail bond. And now he could face the death penalty. Now, I mention this not because this is in any way shocking or inappropriate given the scale of his crimes, but because there's a double-mindedness that is here so apparent. Had these babies been murdered just seconds before he did it, he would be celebrated as a prominent abortion doctor. But the separation of just a few seconds is all it takes to transfer what was supposedly legal into a capital crime. Now, just think about the insanity of that. What is the insanity about the fact that just a few seconds separates a baby who supposedly could just die at the whim of his mother with the work of a doctor to one that is then a life worthy of protection, such that murdering him or her would lead to the death penalty? I can't think of anything that demonstrates our moral irrationality any more clearly than this. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmohler. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.